guns can be. And like all of us who grieve over the high number of young people being killed, Pollack is looking for any solutions that could help reduce the number of murders in Chicago.
We have many people in the city who are walking around carrying these really lethal weapons and causing tragedies for themselves and other people. And if we can make that less common by the imposition of the risk that they'll face some sort of a mandatory minimum sentence if they're caught, I think we'll save some lives.
That's why Pollack supports Mayor Rahm Emanuel's push to impose mandatory minimum 3-year sentences on all people caught carrying an illegal gun. In fact, Pollack testified in Springfield before legislators considering the law. And his appearance carries some weight because he's the co-director of the University of Chicago Crime Lab, which is dedicated to using science to improve crime policy. So I went to Pollack to see what research he has to show that mandatory minimums will work.
Well, I don't think that we have research that nails it down. I must say, I personally am very influenced by the situation in New York.
The situation in New York, that's something Emanuel and Chicago Police Superintendent Gary McCarthy have repeatedly pointed to.
As you look at all the data in New York, where they've seen a 3-year minimum.
And just look at New York. It couldn't be a clearer example of how to do this.
And if you look at the New York case, and you look at the history of New York that has a truth in sentencing.
The fact is, in New York, where these conditions exist, it's working. I mean, I don't know, what research do we need?
The mandatory minimum punishments is, if you study the New York experience, beside the point.
Frank Zimmering is a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of the book The City That Became Safe, New York's Lessons for Urban Crime and Its Control. He studied 19 years of data tracking crime in New York. In 1990, the city had 2,250 murders. In 2012, they had 419. That's an 80% drop in murder. It's that success that's being used to justify the mandatory minimum sentences being proposed by Emanuel and McCarthy. But mandatory minimums weren't signed into law in New York until late 2006.
2006? That's after 90% of the crime reduction. I think that what's going on is that the superintendent and the mayor in Chicago are under a do-something-fast political pressure. And in my experience, at least, that's never been good for penal codes.
So mandatory minimums were not part of the formula that led to New York's success. But can they deter crime? Superintendent McCarthy has been making the argument that they can. At his weekly press conferences on guns and mandatory minimums, he's been profiling cases where young men who had previous gun charges are either shot or charged with shooting someone. Here he is at the beginning of this month.
Akeem Manago was shot and killed this weekend. In April, less than a year ago, 2012, he was sentenced to 42 months for aggravated battery and 1 year for aggravated UUW. He was paroled on January 28th, and 2 months later, he was shot and killed. With truth in sentencing, he would have been incarcerated instead of on the street to be a crime victim.
It's an emotionally powerful claim your police chief is making. Probably most people's intuition is that it's legitimate, which is why it's an effective public argument. Of course, it's completely intellectually dishonest.
Mike Tonry teaches law at the University of Minnesota.
It's simple, with 100% accuracy, to make statements like that retrospectively. Say, this guy was convicted, didn't go to prison, 6 months later committed an offense. Don't you see, if he had been sent to prison 6 months ago, this wouldn't have happened.
But Tonry says the problem is that if you go back 6 months and look at the number of people who came to the attention of police that day, there's no way to know which ones would reoffend in the future unless you lock them all up, and that gets costly. The Illinois Sentencing and Policy Advisory Council has studied Emanuel's mandatory minimum and told legislators that if the law had been in effect over the last 3 years, it would have cost the state an extra $400 million in incarceration expenses. Tonry says there are much more effective ways to spend that money to bring down crime.
You could do some things with greater police intensity, changes in paroling techniques, all kinds of work, outreach work with gangs, all kinds of community center stuff that would probably be more effective.
In a 2009 paper on mandatory minimums, Tonry looked at sentences before laws took effect and after. And surprisingly, he found that the sentences were often exactly the same. So the mandatory minimums had no effect, because prosecutors and judges simply found ways to work around them, most commonly by bringing charges without attached mandatory sentences. That's why Tonry says mandatory minimum laws are just political theater and fall into a category of law called expressive punishment laws.
Laws that are meant essentially to convey a message to the public, irrespective of what they do in practice. And since your mayor is a smart guy, and I'm sure he is surrounded by smart people, I have no doubt that they perfectly well understand that this is a symbolic proposal that they're making, and if it's enacted, they will claim credit for having responded to public anxieties and done something about it, whether or not it's likely to have any effects in the real world.
But so what? What's wrong with passing a law that says we as a state take it very seriously when people carry guns illegally? Well, Tonry says, if the mandatory minimum proves misguided, as such laws often have, they're tough to take back.
No state has yet repealed any major bit of expressive tough-on-crime legislation. It's really hard to do.
When you commit a serious gun offense, you should serve the time. The victims deserve it, the public demands it, and the criminal justice system should deliver it.
Emanuel has said he's confident that mandatory minimums will be part of any new state gun legislation. I'm Robert Wildeboer.
Support comes from the Illinois Symphony Orchestra with violinist Nicholas Kendall in Virtuosic Vibe with Sibelius Violin Concerto, Strauss Death and Transfiguration, and a world premiere by Steve Hackman. 8 p.m. Friday, April 12th at Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts and Saturday, April 13th at Sangamon Auditorium. Details at ilsymphony.org.
The Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 12th of April, 2013. It was on this day, 1633, Galileo Galilei stood trial before the Roman Inquisition to defend the publication of his book, Dialogue Concerning the Two Chief World Systems. It all started 90 years before when the Polish astronomer Copernicus published his book, which laid out his revolutionary theory that the Earth and other celestial objects rotate around the sun. It was at odds with the accepted understanding, which the Church promoted, that the Earth was at the center. Copernicus died about the same time he published his book, so he never got into trouble. But Galileo was already famous. He was a respected scientist, one of the first to show that math could be used to explain the laws of nature and to show that falling objects accelerate at a uniform rate regardless of their weight. He was interested in Copernican theory, but what proved it was the telescope. A Dutch eyeglass maker invented it, 1608, and Galileo got one. And he saw that the moon was illuminated by a reflection of the sun from the earth and that Jupiter was orbited by its moons. And he studied Venus and realized that the only explanation for its changing phases was that it orbited the sun. The Church held that the earth was the center of the universe, based on a verse in the book of Joshua that describes God stopping the sun in the sky, and a verse in the Psalms that says the earth was put on its foundations and would not move. Galileo felt that the truth of the Bible was not always literal, that it used metaphorical imagery as well. And he wrote, "I do not feel obliged to believe that the same God who has endowed us with senses, reason, and intellect has intended us to forego their use. He would not require us to deny sense and reason in physical matters which are set before our eyes." And so, April 1533, Galileo was called before the Inquisition in Rome. He was almost 70 years old. He was in poor health. He was condemned. He was put under house arrest. A few years later, he became blind. He died in 1642. The church did not lift its ban on Galileo's book until 1822. Gustave Flaubert's first novel, Madame Bovary, was published on this day, 1857, about a woman who takes on multiple affairs to stave off the boredom of her empty existence. The novel caught the attention of the authorities, and Flaubert was charged with corrupting public morals. He was acquitted, and the publicity from the trial made the book a bestseller. Here's a poem for today by Dana Gioia. Thanks for remembering us. The flowers sent here by mistake, signed with a name that no one knew, are turning bad. What shall we do? Our neighbor says they're not for her, and no one has a birthday near. We should thank someone for the blunder. Is one of us having an affair? At first we laugh, and then we wonder. The iris was the first to die, enshrouded in its sickly sweet and lingering perfume. The roses fell one petal at a time, and now the ferns are turning dry. The room smells like a funeral. But there they sit, too much at home, accusing us of some small crime, like love forgotten, and we can't throw out a gift we've never owned. Dana Gioia's poem, Thanks for Remembering Us, from Daily Horoscope, published by Grey Wolf Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Joy Biles, be well, do good work, keep in touch.
Texas singer Dale Watson writes songs about two